joining. Thanks for joining. Always a pleasure to see familiar names that we've spoken to or met, new names that we are looking forward to meet you guys in the near future, of course. I took some time to kind of try and figure out where people are coming from, and I could tell people registered from a lot from California. We had people from Illinois, Florida, Alabama, Texas, New York, New Jersey. I don't know if I said Florida. Those are at least the ones that are Europe as well. So always a pleasure to do something like this. I think by now everybody got the billboard of the different sources that we have for more information. So I just gonna briefly say before I jump in, all those links that you're looking at, YouTube and podcast, we put a lot of content, educational content on those avenues, channels to help investors do better. So however you consume, you know, this is multiple ways for you to kind of really dive into more truly wealth of knowledge based on actual experience and not necessarily on conventional wisdom. I don't know if that's the right term to use here. We don't use conventional wisdom. We use actual experience. Let me introduce myself. My name is Danny Bate-Orr. I live in Southern California. I've been investing in real estate since 2002. I've been working with investors, assisting them investing in real estate since 2004, I would say, probably 2004. So almost 20 years of helping clients, people, couples, individuals from different parts of the country, primarily different parts of the country, Europe as well, but primarily US-based people who really understand the concept or the ability or the powerness of real estate and want to execute in real estate investing, and realize that sometimes doing it where they live or in their backyard, what we commonly know, is not necessarily in their best interest or best financial interest. And this is where we come in and help people facilitate those type of investments, primarily when it's done remotely. In my career, I have been operating and helping others, myself and others, invest in more than 35 different US metros. You can see some of those states. They're not all of them are on the list. And we focus on what I call long-term residential rentals. And that's, normally mostly single family homes, duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes. And over my career, which is almost 20 years, we have helped investors purchase over just about 5,000, give or take, transactions of those types of properties. So this is personally who I am. Like I said, I'm in Southern California, enjoying hopefully the last day of rain for the past few months. Hopefully things will warm up finally. It's been kind of quite a weather over here. I want to give you a warning before we dive in. This is, it's going to be a little bit sarcastic, but it's a true warning. Tonight is not a quick TikTok, Twitter type of a lecture or class. I'm really going to dive in. I'm going to talk. It's going to be an hour plus. I'm going to take questions gladly after I'm done with the talking, just so I'm not kind of shifted away from the focus of the presentation. So feel free to dive in or type in your questions while I speak. Maybe mention which page you're on. We can always go back to. So I apologize for not taking questions while I speak. It's a little bit distracting. I'll try to answer. I'll stay here. I've blocked my evening. So if we need to stay multiple hours here, no problem. I have patience to answer. So I'm not rushing anywhere. But I do want to say the following. If you're here and you're thinking this is going to be 5, 10, 20 minutes, it's not. It's going to be much longer. Be ready. Bring your coffee, your wine, your dinner, whatever. So be prepared for that. All right. So that's one thing. No breaks. This is hardcore real estate right here. Second, if you're expecting some sort of a sales pitch at the end, some boot camp, some course, a piece of property I'm going to offer you, ain't going to happen. I'm going to disappoint you in that as well. So there's no sales pitch at the end. I will talk a little bit about our services, just so you know who we are And that's going to be the, you know, the wrap of it. So if you're expecting more or someone to push you some sort of a product, not tonight, so guys, not tonight. All right, so be ready, take a breather, get ready with, you know, comfortable, you know, please close all other windows. So I'm seeing you, checking your Facebook right now, close that down and be focused on this because this is not happening every evening. All right, let's get started. What I'm going to talk about, I'm going to talk about some of the fundamentals of U.S. real estate investing. I'm talking about how to select the market. I'm going to talk about how to evaluate and select a property. I'm going to talk about the purchase process and kind of give you some tips and suggestions how to get ready or better prepared to invest in real estate. That's generally what the plan for tonight. I'm going to sometimes slow down, sometimes rush through a slide because I feel it's kind of not as critical, but I do want to go over a few things. With that said, let's get started and dive into things. I hope you're ready. Let's get started. When we talk about real estate, and this is what I call the awesomeness of real estate, the first thing I want you to internalize and remember or be reminded, you may know it, but I want to remind you, is what I call the mortgage miracle. What is the mortgage miracle? In the U.S., when we get a 30-year fixed mortgage, your mortgage payments are fixed for the next 30 years, meaning they're not indexed. They're not pegged to the cost of living. We all know that. There's nothing new about it. Well, let me tell you something. If you're able to detect, I have a little bit of an accent, you will probably understand that I'm originally from a different country. You grew up in Israel and in many other countries around the world, including Israel. When you get a mortgage, your monthly payments are pegged, are indexed, meaning when the inflation goes up, like we're seeing here, the payments is also going up, right? So if we start, let's just use round numbers. Let's say I get a mortgage, I don't know, 5 years ago, and the index was a certain number, and my monthly payment, it's a beautiful even $1,000 a month, right? 5 years later, inflation went up all of a sudden, or not so all of a sudden, I am paying $1,300, right? Maybe next year I'll pay $1,350. Maybe the year after the inflation will go down, I'll go down to, you know, $1,200, right? Those things fluctuate. In most countries, your mortgage is going to be indexed and fluctuate over time based on the index. It's, you know, based on the index or inflation. Why am I mentioning it? Because in this country, in the U.S., when we get a mortgage, our mortgage is fixed for the next 30 years. The only time it will change is if in the next 30 years, sometimes in the next 30 years, we're going to refinance and take a different mortgage, refinance to a lower rate, do something else, then of course it will change. But if any of you refinance or purchase through 2020 and 2021 and maybe 2022, when the rates were low, and you locked it at 2.5, 3, 3.5, 4%, right? I don't know if you all remember that was the rates about a year and a half ago or so. If you are one of those people who locked that low rate for the next 30 years, this is not going to change, not the rate and not the monthly payment. If you really think about it, it's very, very powerful and a gift to us, the borrowers, right? Because obviously, there's inflation. We all understand inflation now, right? So there's inflation in this country. Rapid inflation right now, normally not as that rapid, but even when things are normal, there's still an inflation of 3%-ish a year. And that means the property value goes up over time. The rents that we are collecting goes up over time. The property taxes goes up over time, et cetera, right? Maybe the salaries, the income also kind of goes slowly over time. What does not go up over time with the basic, you know, as long as we don't touch our mortgage? The monthly payments, right? So if you really think about it, this is a very, this amazing gift that it's giving to us, the borrowers in the U.S., and it's not, excuse me, it's not how it's normally, you know, given to people in other countries. So right there, everyone who understands this, a little bit of an abstract notion, should really, you know, internalize this and get that just this mere fact, that just one line, mortgage miracle, makes real estate in the U.S. much more amazing than other countries, right? So Mortgage Miracle is one of my favorite things that I think it's important to be aware, not to take for granted. And if we are aware and are not taking for granted, then at least be reminded of it. Second thing I want to talk about, also very trivial, you probably heard about it, that's leverage, right? What's so new about leverage? Actually, nothing new, but I want to emphasize a few things. Leverage means we're bringing our own cash, we're leveraging our own cash by getting a mortgage and buying that piece of property, right? Now, in real estate, or at least let's stay in our world of in real estate investing, we can't put 20% down, 80% mortgage, right? And sometimes we do maybe 25, but let's just keep it simple, 20-80. That means that we get a significant amount of leverage or significant power of leverage by borrowing 80% of the funds that we need. Why is it so amazing? Is because if you really think about it, or you compare where else can you get that amount of leverage, the answer is pretty much nowhere except real estate. If you go and borrow stocks, you're never going to get 80%, you know, on that leverage. If you go and open you want to start a business and you go to the bank, the bank is not going to give you 80% mortgage or loan on that business. Maybe 50%, maybe it's a higher rate. So there's a lot of avenues you can borrow, but very few, if any, other avenues that besides real estate that will give you 20-80, which is pretty amazing. So when you think about leverage, I know it's for granted and we all know we can get leverage, but if you really think how powerful it is, that is something that is pretty, you know, pretty amazing to do. And the way I like to kind of really mix it with the reality is the type of real estate I like to invest in with the leverage is the type of real estate that when we rent it out, the income that we're getting, the rent covers my expenses, cover my mortgage payments, what's called the debt service, and I get to keep maybe a few bucks, not a lot, as a positive cash flow. So that means someone else, the tenant, the rent, is paying for my, you know, for my, you know, not just my expenses, but for my leverage. So that's kind of a very powerful tool that we all know exists, but do we really understand how powerful it is? The other thing I want to mention is what we all know that, you know, there's real, you know, tax deductions. So when you buy real estate, the best way to look at it is as if you're buying a small business. Let's just even call it a tiny business, right? And I'm using tiny businesses because it's kind of easy to understand. My little business has income, rent. It has expenses, property management. It has mortgage, maybe repairs, insurance, property taxes, all sorts of things, right? We all know that there's types of expenses that are coming from renting a property. Let's not call them expenses from, you know, from money, from renting a property. Let's call it expenses from operating my little business. The IRS tells you you're running a little business and you can deduct some of those expenses, right? Many of those expenses, such as mortgage interest, the HOA, insurance, all of those things. You live in the Bay Area, let's just use, or New York, and you buy a property in the really awesome Nashville, and once a year, you go and visit your property, the flight, the hotel, the car, the rental car, the meals are all deductible. It's allowed, right? If you don't abuse it, it's allowed, right? The fact that you're scheduling to visit your Nashville property during, you know, one of the biggest concerts of the year, oh, so be it, right? You might as well. But I'm just mentioning that there's a lot of those deductions that are legally allowed for you to use and then, you know, deduct a lot of those expenses and not pay taxes just on the income or some of the, you know, some of the income. So tax deductions are not just something that we we're given. There are a lot of them. There are many more than I'm mentioning here. There are a few other things such as 1031 exchange, which is we're not going to go into right now, maybe in the questions, but real estate really gives us a lot of what I like to nickname the ability to do legal, you know, tax engineering of our taxes, right? Legally, that's really key to understand. This is all legal. Last thing I want to mention, when all those awesomeness, there's more things, but one of those major features of real estate is what I call the side business effect. And what do I mean by that? A lot of people in my career, when we talk to investors or potential investors over the years, a lot of people tell me they have a full-time job and then they have a, you know, a side hustle, a gig. What's that gig? Sometimes it's driving Uber or something like that. Sometimes it's teaching math or physics or building websites or consulting or training, different things, right? And I always wonder why people do that. I know it's some of it because people want to generate more income. Some of it is just for passion, or it gives them more meaning. And I get it. Very good. Well, real estate is probably an amazing structure to have that side business, side gig, without putting a lot of time into it. And what I mean is, the way I look at it is this. I own a single family home. For example, a single family home. My single family home, and I'm simplifying things and we'll dive into, you know, more the challenges in a minute, but my single family home has one client, and that one client signs an agreement to be my client. In real estate, they call it tenants. I'm just looking at it just as a business right now. So my client signs an agreement that will tell him the rules he needs to behave as being my client. Pretty amazing. Plus, he gives me some security deposit. So my client is already signing an agreement to be my client. And then I have my employee. In real estate, they call them property managers, right? In our expense, we're going to call them an employee or a service provider, right? So I have a service provider, I have a client, and this is my little business. In my little business, I have to make sure that the client is well treated by my service provider. I probably don't need to micromanage my service provider, my employee, but I do want to supervise them, right? Remember, if you think about it as a business, little business, you address it as a business, your mindset as a business, you probably operate it like a business, it will benefit you. So that means I'm not going to tell the property manager, the service provider, to do whatever they want. I'm going to monitor, supervise, check on them, follow up, make sure they're making smart decision, right decision, good decision on my behalf. They're taking care of my fruit tree. Basically, they're taking care of my fruit tree. And they need to nurture my fruit tree. They need to water my fruit tree. They need to fertilize it. They need to check on the fruit tree, maybe trim it. That's how I see it. And this is why my fruit tree is growing. And while it's growing, it's giving me more fruits. In real estate, they call it increase in rent. I just like to call it more fruits. And this is how my little tree grows with equity slowly. Remember, it's slow growth with fruits. And I have my employee, service provider, property manager taking care of things. I just need to make sure they show up to do their work as they are promising me to do when we start the relationship. So this is something, why am I mentioning all this orchard story? Is because I can probably grow a tree in the background of my life without needing to be there day in, day out. If anyone thinks that real estate is something of passive income, it's not, right? I don't think it's a passive income. I also don't think it's a full-time job. It doesn't have to be. It depends on the type of real estate, of course. It can be on a spectrum where you're putting some time into it. So it's not 100% passive, but at the same time, you don't have to be fully working at it while keeping a job, while running your life, family, traveling, et cetera. You can, have your side little business running in the background of your life, not letting it go, not forgetting about it, taking care of it, but you don't have to deal with it day in, day out. There's sometimes, maybe the tree is sick and you have to do a little bit more work. Then it comes, you have to be a little bit more involved. Most times it's in the background. And the most beautiful thing about my tree is once my tree is stabilized and growing, I can just buy another tree, plant another tree, and start growing my orchard again in the background of my life, right? I don't have to be there on a day-to-day visit or the day-to-day to take care of it. There are systems in place to take care of it. And this is something that can be integrated into my life. Again, not 100% passive, but also doesn't have to be 100% involvement on my behalf. You guys, I'm just going to mention, if you have questions, feel free to put them in the chat so we can circle back to them. No problem. All right. Everything sounds amazing, right? Let's talk about some of the common disadvantages, right? What I call the typical things, right? I'm not talking about extreme. Let's talk about the typical things. Number one, time or timer. The reason I'm using time or timer is when we buy a piece of real estate with a mortgage, in order for that piece of real estate, this single family home, to really grow like a tree and produce better for me, I need to give it time, right? It slowly tends to appreciate, even if it goes up and down over, you know, peak and valleys over a period of 10 years or more, it tends to grow slowly, you know, maybe even very slowly over time. So that's the first reason, you know, we need time, give it time, it will work wonder. Two things are happening, mainly slow growth in value appreciation, and slow reduction of the mortgage principal. So we have equity starting to grow over time, slowly. Second thing, you know, a part of it is timer, meaning everything I'm talking about is completely theoretical, completely abstract. If you don't actually purchase the house, get the mortgage, and start that timer clock ticking in your favor, right? So if we're sitting and listening, it is not a problem for me because I'm not, you know, I'm doing it. But if someone is just thinking about it, that clock is not ticking in your favor. No equity is going to start growing in your favor until you actually own the piece of property. Okay, so that's a disadvantage. Second thing, unlike what many experts or not, I don't know, commercials or ads or Facebook, whatever, say, you can no money down. I have to admit that I have tried for 20 years to do no money down. I have been very close 2 to 3 times to do no money down deals. Honestly, I've never been able to actually pull the deal and do no money down deal. I'm sure it's available out there. I just want to say realistically, if you're focusing on that and you're not trying to accomplish a transaction with no money down, maybe you want to start thinking if this is even possible, right? Maybe one of you is actually already doing no money down deal, is very successful, you know, kudos for you. My experience has been, you need some cash. We're going to talk about that, you know, in a few minutes, you know, to use as a down payment in order to buy that piece of property. So no money down, I think it's a little bit of a unrealistic. Money down payment is needed, right? So you need some cash. We're going to talk about that, you know, in a few minutes as well. And then there's what I call the typical drama. What is a typical drama? A typical drama for me are primarily the following. When you buy a piece of real estate and you have a tenant, you know, in that property and using a property manager, the following things will happen. You will have repairs. It will happen, I promise, right? You will have vacancy, right? Properties, some areas in the country, some parts of DC, some, you know, maybe parts of New York, Manhattan, some parts of Silicon Valley, and there are other pockets. You put a house on the market, you know, for lease before the truck of the current tenant moves out. The truck with the new tenant is already parked, ready to come in, right? That happens sometimes in some pockets. Most of the country, rest of the areas, one tenant moves out, you clean the house, you prep whatever is necessary, you put the house on the market, and then you wait. It could be a week, it could be a month, it could be a month and a half, it could be even two, you know, during the winter. It doesn't mean every year you're going to have 2 months of vacancy. That's normally not what's happening. Normally you will have some time, you know, maybe 2 to 3 weeks on average, a year, on average a year, that the house will be vacant between tenants. Be ready. It's going to happen, right? So vacancy, maintenance. When you use a property manager, even if you work with our property managers that we carefully pick them and vet them, or other property managers, you will have miscommunications, right? They will try to make a good decision on your behalf sometimes. They will think they communicated something or not, or they promise to do one thing and the vendor going to the house is still doing something a little bit different than what he promised or what he was asked to do. those things will, or they explain something and you thought and this will happen. So when you work with property managers expect miscommunications, it will happen. So be ready for that, right? It's not a necessarily a catastrophic situation. It just means it will happen. Lastly, in what I call the typical drama, you will have evictions, right? How many? I don't know. It depends where you're buying. In our, you know, parts of the type of real estate we do, parts of the country we invest in, we see evictions maybe once every 7 years on average, maybe even longer than that. So evictions are not very common, but they will happen. It will happen. So be aware of that. You know, you cannot eliminate that altogether. I just want to make sure I don't see any questions. I don't want to see any comments. So I'm just hoping everybody's okay. Jessica, you're hinting, you're nodding. So I know you can hear me. Okay. I guess we're good. I guess the speaker is really good with explaining. I cannot draw any other conclusion. All right, let's move on. I want to talk to you about how I go about picking metros around the country where I would like to invest. So remember, I live in Southern California. I used to live in Northern California. So, you know, for the past 10 years, I'll probably be 10 and 10 in each or just about. All my career, I invested in other parts of the country. I've never invested just where I live. So I have a very clear methodology, recipe, how to select an area. I do want to mention, as someone who's been in this, doing this for almost 20 years, actually 20 years, 21 years as an investor, the crash of 2008, which I came into with a lot of properties personally and many more properties through my clients, that crash really had me go afterwards in 2009 and 2010, go back to my drawing board and kind of take everything that I was already doing and just polishing and refining it and just making sure I'm doing things better, stronger, smarter, more resilient, more conservative, just to be do it even better than before, right? So the crash is something that I never know if I'm a survivor of the 2008 crash or more of a graduate. I think it's more of a graduate than someone who kind of survivor than just, just by that. But this is something that I've definitely, everything that I'm talking about tonight, a lot of it is based on the things that happened during the 2008 crash, you know, personally and with my clients. I'll be happy to elaborate about that more if someone brings it up in the Q&A section. All right. Number one on my list, population size, right? When I say population size, I want to see any metro that I'm considering to be at least 1 million people population-wise, ideally 1.5 or more. Most of our metros are actually that we are active in right now are more than 2 million people population-wise, right? I'm talking about the population of the metro, not the city. So when I say St. Louis, I'm not talking about the city of St. Louis. I'm talking about the metro of St. Louis, just to make sure we are on the same page. And I want to see that metro size is, you know, ideally no less than 1 million. And I'd rather be in a 2 million, 1.5 or 2 million or more type of a metro. So population-wise is number one. Number two, I want to see who are the major employers in that metro. It could be Fortune 500, it could be Fortune 1000, it could be other big employers that are not necessarily on that Fortune 500 or 1000 list. But at least I want to see there are multiple big employers representing multiple industries, right? So as an example, I'm not a big fan of Vegas because you do have multiple big employers, right? Every hotel in Vegas, it's a mega employer in many ways, but they're all sitting on the same industry, which is entertainment. Mega industry, but I don't like that as a resilient factor. And we've seen it twice. The crash of 2008 proved that to be correct way to think about it. And the crash, or not the crash, the COVID era also, you know, impacted that. So for me, Vegas is not an area I want to be, although it has the numbers in population. I'm not feeling, I don't have this sense, the same sense of resilient, right? Again, it's not catastrophic if someone is already investing in Vegas or someone doesn't listen to this point and goes and investing. It's fine. I am really thinking about resilient. And while there are other markets in the country that are, I think, can present a more resilient resilience, that's something I am kind of targeting or going after, because I have seen what happens to an area during the crash of 2008, a resilient area versus not as a resilient area, and how devastating it was for values, employment, etc., to the non-resilient or the less resilient one, right? So I'm trying to think about resilient quite a lot. Again, someone who graduated from the 2008 crash, that's in my DNA already. I can't help it. I want to see what are the projected employment and population growth to that metro, right? So I want to be, if we talked about real estate really loves time and I'm going to hold a piece of property for a lengthy period of time, I want to make sure we are going to be seeing an influx of people moving in for jobs and for growth. Those are going to be maybe future tenants, maybe future buyers, but all in all, those people will bring the demand for housing, different type of housing altogether. And I want to be on that receiving path of the migration pattern in the U.S. There is a migration pattern in the U.S. going back 20 or even 30 years and projected to continue, showing some of the Midwest, not all of it, and some of the Northeast are kind of shrinking, and mostly the South and other parts of the Midwest are growing, right? So we want to be on the growth pattern and not on the where people are moving out of. I want to be in states that are landlord friendly, right? The laws are landlord friendly, meaning when we have a tenant and the tenant is not paying or giving us